This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Selesnick with Howard Wilkinson. This year marks the 40th anniversary of David Mann's entry into politics. He was first elected to Cincinnati City Council in 1974, served 18 years as a council member and mayor, was elected to the 103rd Congress in 1992, and served one term in the House representing Ohio's 1st Congressional District. Last year, he ran and won a seat on City Council. Cincinnati Vice Mayor David Mann joins us to look at 40 years of political change in the city of Cincinnati. You can join the discussion by calling us at 513-419-7100 or emailing us talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome, David Mann.
Welcome.
Well, hello. Good to be here. Thank you.
You know, David, you were actually first appointed to City Council May 15th, 1974, a vacant seat. Vacated by Jerry Springer under very unusual circumstances.
Right, yeah.
And the current mayor of the city of Cincinnati was 3 months old at the time.
I know. He made the point of telling me that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fact.
I know.
So, I mean, you've seen a lot. Now, you know, I believe you're the only military veteran that's on council at this point.
Wendell Young was in,
Wendell Young,
was in the Marines.
That's true. You're right. Yeah. Yeah. Your service in the Navy, and I mean, that had to be formative for you. Because
sure, in many ways. Absolutely.
Tell us about the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Well, you know, my first exposure to the real world and anything other than academic context was my 4 years of service in the Navy. It was a wonderful experience. Mostly it was peacetime. I traveled. I got to know myself as an adult. I was faced with the need to communicate with the sailors that I was responsible for, provide leadership, and get to know myself. And in the middle of all that, we had a 30-day venture called the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was kind of scary for 3 days when we didn't know what was going on, and then it got to be kind of boring. Unfortunately, it ended happily and in a peaceful way. But the first few days, by chance, I was on a ship. It was one of the very first ships in Cuban waters. Some of you will recall that the president gave his speech on Monday, and we were already down there on Saturday morning, and the captain said to me, we're going to have the invasion tomorrow, so we need to rehearse our capacity to provide naval gunfire support to our troops. So there were a few hours that were scary.
Yeah. You went on to Harvard Law School.
I did.
And you came back to Cincinnati to practice law. What was the inspiration to get you into politics in the first place?
Well, John Kennedy. I mean, he was the first president I had the chance to vote for. He was my commander-in-chief. And I really took it to heart when he said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And for some crazy reason, despite my essentially introverted personality, I was attracted to politics. And when I came back to Cincinnati, I had an interest in finding a way to get involved. And fortunately, because otherwise I don't know how I would have done it, I came to the attention of Tom Lucan, who was running for city council. He'd been away from city. I guess he lost the race in 67. And so I was involved in the 69 campaign and worked in several other campaigns. And then myself ran unsuccessfully in 1973. So one thing led to another. And when Jerry's seat became vacant, you may recall there was two seats became vacant within two weeks of each other. Tom Lucan had been elected to Congress, and Jim Sissel and I had a knockdown dragout, which I lost, and he was appointed to replace Tom Lucan. But then Jerry's problems cropped up, and 2 weeks later I was appointed to replace Jerry.
And that first council you were elected to, who were your colleagues?
When I was appointed, you mean?
Well,
Ted Berry was the mayor, the first African-American mayor of the city. Charlie Taft was a colleague. After a few days of calling him Mr. Taft, he said, if you don't call me Charlie, I'm not going to talk to you. I said, yes, sir, Mr. Charlie. And he, you know, in so many ways, he is a legend. And I recently read with great interest The Bully Pulpit by Doris Kearns Goodwin about his father and about Teddy Roosevelt. But there were a lot of references in there to Charlie Taft as a young boy. So I found that fascinating. Bobby Stern Bill Chenault, Jim Sissel, of course, Guy Guggenberger, Helen Hinckley, and Tom Brush. That was the council to which I was appointed.
So there were some icons of Cincinnati politics.
Absolutely. And I count myself very fortunate to have had the chance to serve with Ted Berry and Charlie Taft. Of course, Bobby and I served together for a long time. But Ted Berry, I mean, in his lifetime, and actually it was in my lifetime, he'd been denied membership to the Cincinnati Bar Association simply because he was black. And later, somewhat embarrassingly, he was admitted to membership. So he was such a leader in so many different ways, and he was the one that, when he was out of the fear that under PR he might become mayor, at least that seemed to be one of the motivations. That
proportional representation.
Yeah, proportional representation. Thank you. Mm-hmm. That system had been changed to 9X, the current system.
What was council like in those days compared to now? I mean, the council's gone through a lot of changes. Of course, now there's a strong mayor, but describe what it was like to serve in the 70s.
Well, I think it was more of a truly part-time job. And a couple years before, the annual pay had been $4,000. And I think when I was appointed, it was $8,000, and there was, which didn't represent very much even then. And later, the charter was amended to provide that council would be paid a percentage, 75% of what the county commissioners were paid. The city was much larger. 425,000 people. Now we're barely 300,000. The first election that I won, I finished ninth, which is the last spot that you can win. And I had 44,000 votes. I'm pretty sure that the top vote getter this last election was substantially below 44,000. So you have a smaller population, and of course, voter participation has declined. I think we were a much stronger city manager system in those days, and there was more deference paid by the council to the city manager, and that certainly has changed. And you say we have a strong mayor. We don't really, at least if you read the city charter. The chief administrative officer is still the city manager, and we're all supposed to pay deference to him. Now, obviously, when the mayor is directly elected, there's a public expectation, and I think there's an expectation of whoever's successful in that race that that person will have a lot of clout, and they do. And we have some inevitable tension, more than we used to, because someone who's worth his or her salt and has successfully been elected as mayor has an admirable ego and some desire to be in charge. And yet the city manager is there, and he's the chief administrator, he or she's the chief administrative officer. So there's some natural tension that we're still working through.
We're talking with Cincinnati Vice Mayor David Mann. If you have a question or a comment, 513-419-7100. Email us, talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and it's been 40 years since David Mann first entered politics.
I believe it was from 80 to 82 and 91 that you served as mayor.
That's correct.
In those days, the mayor's job was more or less a ceremonial position. I mean, what was it like?
Well, the mayor was picked from the council by the council, so it was more a parliamentary form. Mm-hmm. And the mayor's office then also was a bully pulpit. So the mayor, whoever the mayor was, had the option of deciding, these are some priorities I want to bring attention to and emphasize. And it was true even then that a mayor could convene a press conference and people are going to come and listen to what you might have to say. So there's some opportunity to have impact. Then also the mayor had a special pipeline to the city manager. The city manager's office then and now is just across the public anteway from what each other. So there's constant contact. So it's not quite true that it was just ceremonial, but it certainly has evolved since then. Something else, you asked me what changes are. In those days, and until fairly recently, the council chambers, there was only one raised dais, and that's where the mayor sat. And then the rest of us sat at desks in a U-shape. We were fairly close to each other, and we were looking at each other, which allowed, I think, for a more intimate kind of conversation. I don't like the current setup where there's this elevated, curved podium where really it's very difficult to see a lot of my colleagues. And when I talk, or when any of us talk, we're not really talking to each other. It's very difficult to speak into the mic and turn. So we're sort of speaking into the ether world out there, and of course there's a constant. We didn't used to have cameras running all the time, so I think there's that leads. I don't think it's intentional, but I think it leads to longer conversations, longer speeches, and the level of debate sometimes ranges far away from the details of what we're dealing with. And I do sit there sometimes. I wonder who that person thinks he or she's talking to, and what does that have to do with the decision that we're supposedly discussing?
Well, I remember that.
Was that set up because of security? Was it changed because of security?
I'm not sure why it was changed, to tell you the truth, but in those days, I do remember that, you know, you were looking at each other, looking at each other in the eye.
Right.
And speaking back and
forth. And fairly close to each other.
Very close to each other.
So I think that, I've heard it said that security was one of the concerns. I think it's a much more attractive place. I just don't happen to think it's as functional as we would like.
Well, one of the things was that in those days, just anybody could walk up to you
during
city council and try to bend your ear, too.
including some people. Well, you remember Fifi.
I certainly do.
Rockefeller and some others.
Well, I used to do it myself.
yeah, exactly.
Well, that's right, because right now reporters can't even cross a line.
No.
You know, right after the election, I visited a council meeting, and before the meeting, I just jumped over the rope there and just go up to Roxanne, and she says, "You can't do that. You're going to get in trouble crossing over." I said, "Well, help me here." So, no, she said, "I'm serious. They're very, very vigorous about enforcing that." So.
But that time as mayor, I mean, as you say, you could use it as a bully pulpit, and you could attract attention to particular issues or whatever. Were there any that stand out in your mind that you were able to either jumpstart or introduce while you were mayor?
Well, I had of course, you know, those were the days when we had 1 year terms. So therefore, and this was a bad part of that system. Therefore, particularly the first term, I felt a desire to take full advantage of the 1 year because I wasn't sure that I would ever have that opportunity again. So number one, there wasn't an opportunity to be anywhere that I didn't accept.
Yeah, and, meaning 1 year as mayor.
Yeah. Jim Borgman ran some cartoons sort of making fun of the fact that I seemed to be cutting ribbons all over the place, and I was pretty promiscuous in giving out keys and proclamations and all the rest. And the theme that we tried to organize that first year around was calling it the Year of the Citizen, and we tried to identify people that were making special contributions as private citizens. We had a monthly award, a committee that picked people who deserved to be awarded. Contributions to the community in that way. My second time as mayor, there were some issues with the school system, and I organized what was called the Mayor's Summit on Education and soapbox meetings throughout the community. We had about a number of sites on a Saturday morning where people gathered and gave input with facilitators, and then we tried to consolidate that into a report. And it kind of laid a better foundation for the school levy that had just failed, and the next time around it passed. So, you know, you pick those kinds of things that you can work on, and then there's some natural problems that always come up, and you have to respond to those. Whether it's, you know, we were within hours of having a strike, the first time I was mayor, a strike of the firefighters, and I remember the Cy Murray and I were in Judge Winkler's courtroom. We were within minutes of the proclaimed strike time. And the question is what we were going to do. And I just didn't want to be mayor because there had been a fire the day before up in Mount Adams. And, the reality that I might be mayor when the firefighters went on strike, and then how long would it be before we had loss of property, loss of lives. And fortunately, we were able to avert the strike. So
then 1992 came around, and Charlie Lucan, who was in Congress representing the first district one term, suddenly decided he wasn't going to run for reelection.
After the primary.
After the primary. And you decided to run.
I did.
And you had to run in a very competitive primary.
Eight-way primary.
Yeah, in September, I guess.
August.
That's right, August of that year.
When nobody was paying any attention to politics.
Yeah. What prompted your decision to jump into that race?
Oh, I had always wanted to be in Congress. That was always my aspiration. And, of course, as long as there was a Lucan around in the seat, it didn't like it was look like it was ever going to happen. And who would have believed that Charlie, after the primary, in his first term, would decide he didn't want to continue? And so the opportunity presented itself. We had 3 weeks from his announcement, I think it was 3 weeks, and the special primary. It so happened I was raising money for a judicial race, so I had a bit of a head start there. But in August, nobody votes. And it was so I won. Bill Bowen was number two, and I won by 200 votes. And that was how close it was and how difficult it was because there was almost nobody voted. I remember going around on that election day and not seeing many voters.
And the Republicans had had a primary where they chose a candidate who was pretty weak in terms of name recognition and that sort of thing, and they couldn't replace him.
That's right. They had run a primary. Actually, they'd had the primary at their regular town.
Right.
And the candidate they ended up with messed up his petitions.
Yeah.
And so he did not qualify as a Republican candidate. The Republicans did not have a candidate. So he's filed as an independent and became anointed as a Republican candidate. But because the Republicans had failed to put up anyone, they couldn't replace. They didn't have a vacancy.
Yeah.
And I remember Bob Taft was the Secretary of State then, and Kim Blackwell was trying to get on the ballot because he's the one that barely lost to Charlie Lucan in 1990. And bless him, Bob Taft said, you know, the law doesn't permit me to open this up. And I'll always respect highly Bob the law seemed clear, but as you know, Secretaries of State sometimes exercise discretion. But in any event, so I had a softer ride than I otherwise would have had. But then Jim Burns, the Libertarian, was running then also.
Yes.
And even with that, the nature of the district is such that I only got 51% of the vote. And everybody in Washington knew I was in big trouble the day I started. I was convinced I wasn't, but they were right.
Yeah. Well, in hindsight, I mean, you know, 1994, obviously,
oh, sure,
ran and lost to Steve Shabbat.
Sure.
Was the Newt Gingrich contract with America.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't have won no matter what. But even in a regular year, it was a hard fit for me and the district.
Was it what in particular made it a hard fit? Was it?
Well, it's the western side of the county. It was I don't know, 60% of the city where I did very well because I'd always done very well. I had a good franchise with the voters there. But you get out in the county, and it doesn't fit my profile. And it's a more conservative group. You got abortion issues, some of those things. And then on top of that, there was the contract on America, and there were some issues that had come through. You know, we'd passed a crime bill.
I'm going to correct you. The contract with America. I remember once I misspoke on the air, and actually said contract on America by mistake.
Well, Democrats called it the contract on America.
That's not what they called it. So okay. Clarify.
But that crime vote.
The crime bill. Yeah. I voted on that in August, and right. It was money for police officers. But it also had some programs that were aimed at inner city kids, and it was was slammed by the right as midnight basketball league. So I remember I thought it was a bill that deserved support. I was proud to vote for it, and I remember coming home that weekend and speaking at a festival on the west side. I mean, they'd asked me to come speak, and I'm introduced, and that had just happened, and I was booed. I've never been booed before in my life, particularly in front of a group that I've been asked to speak to, and it was because of feelings about the crime bill. So anyway.
They just beat you over the head with that.
Oh, yeah, they did. They did.
One of the things before we run out of time that I want to make sure we bring up is you were involved recently in the Beyond Civility Project. And a program where you're trying to get people from both sides of the aisle to come in, sit down and have a civil conversation. Do you think politics is truly less civil now than it was when you started 40 years ago?
Well, I think people feel that it is. And of course, if you read about what Lincoln went through and what Washington went through and what our country has gone through at various times, we're just reverting back maybe to what used to be the situation. But television makes it, the communication is more intense, and we see it and we react to it. And we don't like the sense that nothing is happening in Washington. So that's part of what drives us. And as we had those Beyond Civility programs, and this continues since I stepped down when I became a candidate last year, people are hungry for a different model. They really are. And people would prefer that they say that that people have a sincere, respectful discussion about their differences and not get into all the other stuff. But as you know, the reason negative advertising is used and continues to be used is not because anybody likes it, but because it works. And you know, we get what we deserve. If we allow ourselves to be influenced by negative advertising, then it is going to continue. And but Beyond Civility has had a number of interesting programs, side-by-sides. And then, I don't know if you're familiar with the back-to-back program. I'm going to be on one in September. And what this is, you defend a position that's different from your normal position. So I'm going to be on a panel, the other person will be George Vincent, past chair of the Republican Party, a manager of Major Dinsmore Show. And what I'm going to do is explain why we shouldn't have incomes to or shouldn't have programs to address income disparity. And he's going to explain why income disparity and inequality are things that we need to address governmentally. So we have to marshal our arguments and depart from our normal frame of reference. So this has happened before. There was one with, I believe, Denise Driehaus and a Republican legislator. Apparently it was very interesting.
One quick question.
Yeah. You know, I saw you many times in the years when you were out of office, right. And you seemed perfectly happy. what made you decide to go back?
You know, the same thing that drove me the first time around. It's important work, and I frankly think I can make a contribution, and I enjoy it. For some crazy reason, I enjoy it. I mean, it's wonderful to have the opportunity to experience this community when in all its diversity, in the way that only an elected official gets to, whether it's very poor community, a more affluent community, you're talking to cross sections that most people don't get to experience very much.
And do you see yourself as sort of having the institutional knowledge that others don't? Or?
Well, I don't. You know, quickly. I don't present myself that way, but I sure have been through some things that the newer people haven't. But you know, we all have something to contribute.
Thank you for being here. It's been a pleasure.
Great to be here. Thank you.
We've been talking with Cincinnati Councilman Vice Mayor David Mann. Cincinnati Edition is produced by Pete Reitmeier. Today's technical director was Bruce Ellis. I'm Marianne Zalesnik with Howard Wilkinson.